ॐ भक्ताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्बत्वाम् अनुसन्धामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी. आवृतं ज्ञानमेतेन ज्ञानिनो नित्यवैरिणा ज्ञानिनो नित्यवैरिणा कामरूपेण कौन्तेय कामरूपेण कौन्तेय दुष्करेणानलेन च दुष्करेण च आवृतं ज्ञानम् एतेन ज्ञानिनः नित्य वायरिणा कामरूपेण कौन्तेय दुष्पुरेण अनलेन च. आवृतं ज्ञानम् आवृतं एतेन ज्ञानम् नॉलेज वन्स नॉलेज one's wisdom and one's jnanam, atma-jnanam, right? One's understanding, one's nishtha, and also one's wisdom in terms of kaushalam, karma-yoga, dharma, adharma, what is to be done, what is not to be done, and also one's jnanam, one's wisdom in terms of viveka, atma-jnanam, atma-anatma-viveka. So one's wisdom in both of these ways. Avratam is covered ena by this, which is kama rupa, by this kama. Etena just literally means by this. Avritam's past passive participle. So jnanam, knowledge, is covered by this. Okay? By this, which is jnaninaha nitya vairina, which is always nitya, always an enemy. Nitya at all times, nitya, always an enemy. To who? For the jnani. For the one who has self-knowledge. For the jnani, for the one who has self-knowledge. Kama is nitya-vairina. It's always an enemy, instrumental, singular. What is kama-rupena? This enemy, which is in the form of kama, which is in the form of desire, whose nature is desire. So the jnana, knowledge is covered by this kama, in the form of kama. He says, hey, Kaunteya, Krishna is addressing Arjuna as the son of Kunti. So, hey, Kaunteya. This kama, which is dushparena. Dushparena means very difficult to satisfy. Pra becomes purna. The root pra means to fill, like to fill up. Dush pra means very difficult to fill, insatiable. Anala, analena. Anala is the word for fire. Fire itself is called anala. But the derivative of the word is na alam asya, for whom there is never enough. Right? Fire, like for instance, say there's a fire, it's never satiated. The more fire, the more fuel that you give it, the more it wants. So it's called anala, right? So it's a good name for fire. So here kama, desire, is likened to fire, because you can never, it can never be fulfilled. So it says, literally, so anala, by the fire, which is dushparena, which can never be satiated. Okay, so the fire itself never has enough. It can never be satiated. So by this, hey Kaunteya, your knowledge is something that's covered by this kama. Kama, which can never be fulfilled, which is like a fire, which an insatiable fire. And this kama is something that is always inimical to the jnani. And so what does that mean? A couple of things. Nitya means it's always there. Right. Nitya, in terms of Brahman, it means timeless. But in terms of the world, it means it's always there, always. So that always is a good word for nitya. It's always there, it's eternally there. So first of all, karma is something that doesn't go away. As long as you're a jiva, the karma's desires are something, as long as you're an ajnani, let's put it that way, and we'll look at the, just any jiva, including an ajnani later. As long as you're an ajnani, karma is going to be there. I need this to be happy, I need that to be happy, I need that to be happy, because ananda is my swarupa. Ananda is my nature. The wholeness is my nature. And as long as my being is identified with my mind, there's no viveka there, right? There's nothing differentiating myself from my mind. Then whenever my mind is not feeling whole, is feeling unhappy, is feeling agitated, you know, is feeling depressed, whatever happens to be there, that's who I am. And as soon as I take myself to be that, then I'm seeking to become, to get my wholeness back. So the whole life, what every person is doing, their entire life, is seeking to get their wholeness back and to maintain their wholeness. To get their well-being, okay, now I'm all right. I don't know. I remember feeling this way once when I was, I hadn't met Swamiji at this time. I was going to school in at Sonoma State College. It must have been 18 or 19. And I remember having this kind of a revelation. It was terrible, actually. It was, I had a moment where everything was fine with me. And I realized it vividly. This is me. This is how I'm supposed to be. This is who I am. And then I realized at the same time as I watched it drift away that I couldn't maintain it. I couldn't keep it. And so it was like getting a glimpse of myself and then realizing that that self was always being lost. Testing. Okay, I think we're okay. That myself is always being lost, right? There's nothing I can do about this. There. And so here what I'm saying is that, and that moment was such a relief and such a sorrow at the same time, you know? And so that's the plight of a samsari, because we're always trying to find and maintain that sense of self that is so elusive. And it's so elusive because there's an identification only with the mind. There's no recognition of that substrate, changeless presence. You know, and so you're totally dependent upon your mind having some semblance of an experience of peace or well-being. And so what that means then is because we don't have a recognition of the self, we are eternally seeking, right? Seeking to find that, seeking to create it, seeking to find an experience that will give it to me, or to find a sense of peace or a place of peacefulness where I can recreate that experience of well-being so that I can say, ah, here I am, this is me. So that's the samsara. That's the terrible plight of the ajnani. So karma becomes, karma is just simply that human desire to find myself. Now, we don't talk about it like that, but that's really what it is, to get myself back. And so we spend all of our time seeking that. Now, for an ajnani, karma is something, if I have a desire for something, this is for an ajnani, this, when the desire comes, there is hope. Hope comes with the desire. In this sense, ah, I really want this. Why is there hope? Because if I had this, if I were to have this, then I would be happy, right? So there's a sense of karma being your friend for the ajnani, and it stays your friend until all of the obstructions come in the way and the thing doesn't turn out as you wanted it to turn out. So karma, but initially karma acts as a friend. So it's not this nitya-vairi. It's not an eternally, from the beginning, an enemy. They'll start out as a friend. If I just have this, I could be happy. So karma's on my side, right? It turns sour in the end. Because even if I do fulfill the desire doesn't last. And as I go on trying to fulfill the desire, all kinds of obstructions come in the way that cause a lot of misery, and in the end I may fulfill the desire and then later I don't want it. It just, and it never goes well in the end. The end game is not usually a happy one. Simply because the object of the desire, I either lose an interest in it or it loses an interest in me or somebody takes it away. This is just how it is. But for an Ajnani in the beginning, it can be a friend because it will take me to happiness. This thing I want so that I can be happy. For a Jnani, it is never a friend. Because the Jnani who knows the self and knows what the truth of the situation is, when the kama arises, there's no such feeling, oh, this is a friend, as though this is now going to make me happy. Rather, it's something that now I have to deal with this. There's a problem. It's treacherous. The kama is treacherous, in a sense. That because now, it's either there's lack of vairagya on my part, or it's not a problem. If there's not lack of vairagya on my part, I can have the kama. I can have the desire and enjoy it. But then it's what we call a dagdha bija. It's like a burnt seed. I have control over that kama. Right? I can take it or leave it. I can enjoy going after something. But also, if I don't get it, if it doesn't go my way, I can let it go. Because my ananda is not at stake. If the kama arises in such a way that I am feeling my ananda, my well-being is now at stake, that becomes inimical to me. I don't have this feeling, oh, this is my friend, you know, if only I can fulfill this desire, then I'll be happy. I wouldn't see it that way at all. It's that this kama now has come and it's disruptive. I have to deal with it. I have to now work on that with shama, with dhamma, to get the proper distance on it so that I can go after that kama freely without a problem, means that I'm not dependent upon it for my ananda, for my fullness. Or else I have to work on that kama in order to get an appropriate distance. So from the beginning, I see it as something that is, I would say, inimical to my peace. It's not a friend to my shanti. And so we can look at it positively like this. It's a friend, the kama, I mean a kama that's coming and grabbing me. This kama is a friend to my shanti because it becomes a sadhana for me to handle. In that way, all right. In that way, it's a friend. Because if I, but what's the real friend? The friend is my buddhi that's handling it in this way. So really, right? But that I'm in a position to handle it, to be with it, to neutralize it, to make it a benign desire. What is a benign desire? It's the template. The whole template is, I want this so that I can be happy. Benign desire is just, I want this. But the superimposition of my ananda has not been given to that object. And so then I can pursue the object. I can say yes or no. I can pursue it so far and not further. I can decide not to pursue it because it's not in my best interests or in the interests of others to pursue it. I can let it go because my being is not at stake. That's a benign desire. So if that's no problem, that desire is not an obstruction to your vairagya, you know, to your dispassion. Like a benign desire. I love my balloon. It's a child. Like, I'm not a child. I'm an adult. I have my balloon. And if the balloon, but if the balloon goes up into the air, I can enjoy that also. It's fine. Nothing happens to me. That's a benign desire. It's not going to be that way for a child, unless it's a very extraordinary child. You know? The balloon goes, it's a major loss. So that balloon analogy is really a good analogy for our balloons. We have a lot of balloons. Can all of those balloons be free to come and go? Then it's a benign desire. It's not a problem. Then the energy that you have in your life, the prarabdha karma, that really gives you desires, right? That's another important thing. The jnani is not desireless. The very prarabdha karma brings along desires, you know, that propel you into the next action. Remember, there's three different things. This is how they break it down in Vedanta. There's three different things that are going to be... There are three different things that are going to be in moving you through your prarabdha karma, the karmas that caused you to take this birth. One is anya icha, the desires from another person pulling you. Then swecha, your own desires, what comes up from you that you want to do. That's what, if you don't have anything, nothing comes from you, then how are you going to move towards something? So you yourself will have your desires. And then anicca, the things not desired by anybody. It's just what the universe presents to you. It's not a matter of desire. It's a matter of circumstance that you find yourself in. So these three things are what propel you. One of them is swecha. So that energy that pushes you into the next, to do the next thing. So it's not as though you gain knowledge and then the antakarna, your mind, becomes desire-free. It doesn't become desire-free. What if you're thirsty? You want a drink of water. What if you're hungry? You want to eat. What if you feel like taking a walk? That's a desire. Your whole life is one desire after another. But are the desires benign? Are they? Do you have a distance on the desire? Do you have control of the desire so that you can take it or leave it? That's the thing. Or does the desire take you? And so for the jnani, if the desire wants to take me, wants to pull me along, then that desire is inimical. I want the choice of being able to say yes or no. I want the choice of being able to let it go. And so for the jnani, the desire is not considered as a friend. It's considered as something to watch carefully. You know, it's just like we say, if you're somebody, your enemy, you can't necessarily get rid of your enemies, but you people who don't wish you well, they might be there, you know, but you don't just do everything they say. You know, you have to keep some viveka there. In reference to that person who's inimical to you, or that which can cause you a lot of harm. You can't just ride along with it. You know, and so there's some distance there. You have to be circumspect. You have to be able to handle it. If you can handle it, they're not an enemy. It's because it's not a problem. And so it's very kind of important viveka discrimination to make there. So let's go to the next verse, because he's building on this now. Indriyani mano buddhihi, indriyani mano buddhihi, asyadhishtanamuchyate, etar vimohayat yeshaha, jnanamavritya dehinam. In the introduction, Shankara introduces this saying, Indriyani, Sandhi, Indriyani, Manaha, Buddhihi, Asya, Adishtanam, Uchate, Etaihi, Vimohayati, Eshaha, Jnanam, Avritya, Dehinam. He introduces this scene with a question. You know, what again is the adhishtana? What is the locus? Where are these desires located? These desires that have the... Where do we find them? Where are they? These desires that have the capacity of covering one's knowledge. And Shankara says, and because of having the capacity to cover one's knowledge, these desires are, he says, vairi sarvasya lokasya. They are the enemy of the whole world, actually. Sarvasya lokasya means of all the whole world. These desires that cover, by their very nature, they cover your knowledge, and in doing that, make you behave in a way that goes against your wisdom, right? Even in terms of what is to be done, what is not to be done, your atma and anatma viveka, they cover that wisdom, and by doing that, this kama krodha, this desire and anger, come up, and so these become inimical to the whole world, he says. So now, thinking of it like that, it's important then to know where they're located, he says. Because when you know, he says literally, when you know where the enemy is, when you know the hideout, the location of the shatru, of the enemy, he says, when you know that, then you can much more easily destroy them. So he says, literally. It's much more easy to destroy them. So now in this verse he says, the indriyas, the sense organs, indriyani, manas, the mind, buddhihi, and the intellect. These three, adishtanam uchate, these three uchate are said to be the adishtanam, the locus of the kama. The sense organs, the mind, the indriyas—they are the locus. They are where the desires are. The desire, kama, is to be found. He says, "Etahi vimohayati eshaha." This kama, eshaha kama, it causes a person. Vimohayati is causal. It causes a person to become deluded in a variety of ways. The V stands for in many different ways. Vimohayati. This kama causes the person to become deluded through these means, through the mind, through the buddhi, through the sense organs. Doing what? It causes the dehi, the person, the indweller, right, the jiva, causes the person to become deluded, avritti jnanam, having covered their knowledge. Having covered the knowledge, this kama causes a person to be deluded through these three things, sense organs, mind, and buddhi. So what it meant there, it's very simple actually. Without your sense organs, there's not going to be any problem. There's nothing there to desire. You don't see anything. Okay? Really. So your sense organs land on something. That's something. Then the mind sees it. Okay, so the sense organs are some of the culprits here. Sense organs land on something. That something lights up in the mind. Okay, the mind feels pleasure. And so the mind thinks, oh, I want that. So now, so that's a manas. So that now the manas has a feeling, an emotion, positive emotion toward the thing. The desire comes in the manas based upon what the senses have perceived. And it can become earlier or later, What I mean is, you can see something, it kind of lights up. Then your mind, sometimes you'll do long examples of, the mind will start, you know, thinking, you know, that thing is really, and he's used a woman's dress in a, you know, if you go shopping, window shopping, he'll have the, you know, a lady go, she sees a sari in the window shopping in Mumbai, you know, walking along, and she sees this beautiful sari in the window, and she's, oh, that's so, it's a beautiful sari. I really like that. But then, you know, she has to get home, so she keeps looking at it, and she goes by, it's so nice. But all the way home, she's thinking, you know, that sari would really look beautiful, especially tomorrow if we're going to go to that party. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a perfect sari. I really think that maybe I should really get that. And she goes home, she's thinking about it. The next day in the morning, she makes sure to go to work going past that very window, looks at it again and thinks, no, I love that sari. Now her buddhi is going to come in. The buddhi, this is just the mind reveling over the sari and, you know, thinking all good things. Should I get the sari? Should I not get the sari? I think that I really, well, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't. And the buddhi comes in and says, you know, I really think you should have that sari. The buddhi comes, now, it has to decide. It has to decide. Now, the buddhi can make a decision and will make a decision. The mind's going to be having all of the emotions and the reveling and the thoughts, should I do it, should I not do it, I want to do it. This is so wonderful, I think I should do it. And it can build up a lot of strength in the mind. The strength and the emotion, the need, the desire becomes so strong that the strength that the desire is building up in the mind can be strong enough to co-opt the buddhi so that the buddhi says, yes, let's go. Right? Mm-hmm. But the buddhi isn't really saying, yes, let's go. The buddhi has become overwhelmed by the kama. And so the manas, the sense organs, you know, gave the manas light for it to see, I want that. Then that desire rises and builds and builds and builds and builds. So you have this emotion and this need and this want. And the buddhi, even though, like, say, for instance, from this story, if Swamiji were to continue it, the woman's buddhi initially could be saying, you know, we can't really, that sari, you know, 500 rupees. You know, pip now be, you know, 5,000 rupees. Okay? That sari, it's 5,000 rupees. We really can't afford that sari right now. The economy is very bad. You know, and we're trying to put money away. You really can't afford that sari. So just put your mind to rest. Let the buddhi's first try. Okay? But as the desire goes on developing, no, we really can. I haven't bought a sari for a long time. I really think that we could, and I do need something to wear, and I think it's okay. No, I'm not. And I really want it. I really, really, really want it. So this going back and forth in the buddhi for a while and saying, no, 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 no. But then coming back the next day, going by, the mind has built up such a need. I have to have it. I have to have that.
I deserve it.
I want that. And finally, the buddhi just checks out. I don't know if you've had that. Have that happen? Just kind of says, just goes away. And you go in and you buy the sari. Right? Or the buddhi might say, yes, let's do it. A lot of times it'll check out. I've had that experience. You know what, I don't have this so much since I've gotten my Kindle. But I used to have this experience, especially when all the bookstores were really up and running with Cody's bookstores. But if I'd be walking down Telegraph, and I love books, I have way too many books, I would be walking down, and I knew that I had too many books, and I didn't really, you know, want to add any more to my collection of unread books or barely read books. So I'd be walking down. And as I'd be walking, even though I know this from when I'm at home, but when I was walking by Cody's, I would go in to the bookstore, look at the books, buy a couple of books, come out, and walk home. No buddhi. It just checked out. It just decided that the kama, the sense organs in the kama, just did their thing. And they were strong enough that my buddhi didn't even come in at all. Okay? Didn't come in at all. I don't know if you've had that experience. It's really very interesting. You had the same experience. Swamiji talks about it in his Bhasha on this. You can have the same experience with taking a second helping of food when you're full. Mm-hmm. You're already full. You're having another piece of pie. The last thing in the world you need is another piece of pie. But, you know, it's so good. And at that time, your buddhi might try to make a little voice. Might try, and often it doesn't even try. Now, that's what's so interesting. When you see that dynamic, these are just in little things. But this dynamic can be in big things, too, where the buddhi is carried away by the manas and the sense organs. It either says, yes, okay, and it goes with it, or it kind of just goes into unmanifest condition, right? And that manas goes. And so now, say This is why Shankara is bringing this out. Say now you start to recognize this pattern. What you're starting to recognize, if you see this, is that actually what has got the control is the kama. If it happens, takes place in the sense organs with the manas, then the buddhi submits and you go without anybody there to hold the reins. That's when the kama is a real kama. When the buddhi is not overwhelmed, when the buddhi is not able to be overwhelmed, right, then the desire is fine. It's another thing that Swamiji's brought up, and it comes all the way through, that's important from previous verses. The kamas that come up in the mind, you don't have any control over that. You can't tell your mind, don't have this desire. You can't do that. All you can do is manage the desires that don't come up. Because the desires that do come up are something that are based upon really your prakriti, your nature, all of your prior experiences, right? All of your past lives, the very prarabdha that brought you here, all of the experiences that you've had that have brought you to this moment, those experiences all put together, and all of your experiences are what are going to be responsible for the thoughts that present themselves to the mind. So you don't have a choice really over what thoughts are going to come up in the mind. You do have a choice on how you handle the thoughts that come up in the mind. That's the important part. And then, of course, as you break, say you have a desire that is inimical to you, that's causing problems for you, that you have recognized as such. You can work with that desire until after a time it dies out. But then that's because you've been working with it, and that's how the prakriti is being formed, and so this desire perhaps dies out or whatever. That's not the point. The point is that you have to be present to what it is that the mind dishes up for you. Just like you have to be present to what your sense organs give you. You can't walk around, so you walk down the street and you can't tell your sense organs, don't see, you know, don't see everything that's there. Only see the good things, you know. When you're going outside and walking, I want you to only see the positive things. I want you only to hear the good things, not the other things. It's like the same thing with the mind. I want you only to have desires that are good, that are benign, that are meant for the well-being of yourself and for others. Those desires you may have, the other desires you can't have. I only want you to have thoughts that are pure and kind and loving. The other thoughts, no, you're not allowed to have those thoughts. This is not reality. No. In fact, one of the beautiful, wonderful things about the Indian culture and Eastern cultures in general is that they tend to know this. They tend to know, in reference to the mind, that dharma and adharma doesn't have to do with the thoughts that come up in the mind or the desires that come up in the mind. It has to do with how we handle those desires. What do we do with those desires? That's where adharma comes into play. Not with what the prakriti, not with what nature is throwing up. And so this is absolutely key to understanding. Krishna is starting out by saying this, you know. You need to know this is where the desires abide, right? They are there in the indriyas, they're in the manas, and they're in the buddhi. So this is where they're located. They're not in the atma, right? The self doesn't have desires. The self is just your pure being. There's no problem there. So this has to be recognized. And then, so now, recognizing it, then what? Okay? So let's get the next verse. Tasmat tvam indriyan yadau. Tasmat tvam indriyan yadau. Niyamya paritarshaba. Niyamya paritarshaba. Papmanam prajahi hyenam. Papmanam prajahi hyenam. Jnana vijnana nashanam. Jnana vijnana nashanam. Tasmat tvam indriyani adau niyamya bharatarshabha papmanam prajahi hi enam jnana vijnana nashanam. Now he says, Tasmat, therefore, Tvam, you. So, hey Bharatarshaba, hey bull among the Bharata race. So he's talking to Arjuna. Hey Bharatarshaba. Therefore, you, Indriyani, Adau Niyamya. Adau, at the very onset, at the beginning, Adi is beginning. So, Adau, at the very onset, Niyamya, having controlled your indriyas, you know, controlling the indriyas at the onset, prajahi, papmanam prajahi, destroy this papmanam, destroy this sinner, this papi, destroy this papi, this one that causes so much harm, right? Destroy this one. He indeed, enam, this kama, enam, this kama, jnana vijnana nashanam, this kama, that is this destroyer of your jnanam, remember, karya akarya, jnanam, your knowledge of what is to be done and what is not to be done, your knowledge of dharma adharma, your atma anatma viveka, your knowledge of yourself and what is not yourself, the one who destroys that knowledge and the one who destroys also your vijnanam. Your vijnanam is the recognition of my being, the aparoksha jnanam, right? The aparoksha jnanam of myself, of this creation as Ishvara. Hey, I'm giving my class. Why don't you tune into it? Okay. Yeah, come on. I'll talk to you later. Krishna. She's got her own ring. Just a note here for Sanskrit people. The word papmanam then, prajahi. Prajahi is the imperative dual. It can also, there's a secondary reading of this, so for Sunday people, look at how this can be read. And so there's two readings of it. Prajahi or prajahihi. Either way is going to be imperative dual. But the way that I'm taking it, because this is how Swamiji takes it, and it's noted in the footnotes as a second reading, second way to read it, you can take it prajahi, hi, enam. You see that? You can take, the sandhi can be broken two ways. Prajahi, hi, enam, or prajahihi, enam. So the best way, the way they did it in Swamiji's book is prajahi hi enam, and that's so. Anyway, the translation is going to be the same. So destroy this one that causes so much suffering in the beginning itself by restraining your sense organs. In other words, what does that mean? When you're walking along and you see the sari. Or you see that the desire pops. It's right there. You pull your sense organs back and you do the viveka. Right there. So that before the buddhi really gets overwhelmed. So you nip it in, what he's saying is nip it in the bud. Bring your knowledge to that situation. That's the idea. It's karma yoga also. When you notice that a desire is starting to be generated in your mind, it's a then, because you've seen something, and your mind starts working around it, right then and there, pull yourself back from it, so that you can have a chance to decide whether I want to go with this or not. It's not to say, don't go with it. It's to say, pull yourself back when you still have a buddhi, right? to make a decision. And that's where to nip it in the bud. Once the manas has started going and building up such a strong desire, it can overwhelm the buddhi and you're just off and running. But before that happens, let the buddhi, you know, pull yourself back. Now here, the sadhana chatushtaya, the fourfold sadhana, viveka, vairagya, mumukshutvam, it's the third one. Shama, dhamma, upadati, titiksha, samadhanam, shraddha. These two samadhamma are what Krishna is talking about here. Shama and dhamma. Dhamma is the one is the ability to pull the mind back. Once a desire has taken place, you know, once the mind wants something, once a reaction has taken place in the mind, right? So once the mind has been caught by something, that's when dhamma comes into play. Shama, when we say shama, the shama is the first one that's cited. Shama means the mind is not problematic. It's not being caught in a reaction. It's not caught by a desire. It's not causing you pain, right? The thoughts just come and go, and you can just dismiss them as they come. Most of your thoughts are like that, right? The great majority of your thoughts, you have shama. The thought comes, it doesn't grab hold of you. You can just let it move on. You can think about it or not think about it. You can look at it, not look at it. It doesn't have a hold on you. So shama is that ability to, where you have your buddhi has the freedom to dismiss the thought or the emotion. It hasn't grabbed you. So that mind, that when the shama is there, the mind is free. That the mind's not causing any problem, right? But dhamma comes in when the mind has been grabbed, right? And so now here, Krishna is saying, when the sense organs land on something, and there's a desire is taking place, right then and there, bring in the dhamma. Bring in the practice of dhamma. Where you decide, you make a decision not to act out on that. And one interesting thing, Swamiji brought up in his bhasha on this. When people who have a spiritual path, we used to do this at the ashram also, we would spend, for instance, 1 or 2 or 3 days practicing Mounam. Mounam is, dhamma. It means you're not going to speak. So you have to gain control over your speech. Some people will practice it like for 2 hours in the morning. Or practice an austerity. You know, the practice of an austerity is something which people do on spiritual paths really in order to get to gain dhamma. Right? Because by practicing that given austerity, your buddhi gains strength. It gains the ability to say no. Some very difficult ones, like for instance, this isn't as difficult, but say practicing dhamma in this way. You decide 1 day a week to fast. In India, that's quite common. Like every Monday, the person will fast. That's dhamma. Because you have to say no. The desires will rise up, you say no. It gives strength to the buddhi. Say you were to decide to be Mounam 2 hours a day. Give strength to the buddhi. So we do these little austerities, but they have a purpose. They build up the strength of the buddhi, learns that, I can say no. And so now, you can have, as an austerity, or as a sadhana, as a spiritual practice, this to watch your desires as they arise. And the first thing that you do as an austerity is to say, wait. Wait is not saying yes or no. It's saying, wait, let me think about it. Let me see whether this desire is something that is good for me or not. That's an austerity. Every time that you do it, your buddhi gains strength in its ability to say no. It recognizes, yes, I can say no. It's like building a muscle. And so here, this is what Krishna is bringing in the Dhamma first. As soon as the desire arises, it's right. The desire arises, it's already come. Right? It's starting at right at the sense organs. If there, you bring in the Dhamma. You say no, then. And then he says, and in that way, you're able to nip it in the bud. You're able to destroy the desire that has the capacity to take away, to take away your knowledge. Now, again, you have to remember, a desire only has the capacity to take away your knowledge if there's no buddhi there to say yes or no. That's the thing. Otherwise, a desire is not a problem. It's not a desire. It's not a problem for you to go after something. It's only a problem if that thing has captured you. And that's the big difference. So initially, until you recognize this whole process, the desire probably just captures you and then you go after it. You know, and then later you think you're in a mess with it and unhappy and being hurt by the whole thing. And then you realize this wasn't a very good idea. This is trying to bring consciousness to that whole procedure. And as you then nip it in the bud. So let's do this one more verse. Indriyani paranyahuhu. Indriyani paranyahuhu. Indriyebhya param manaha. Indriyebhya param manaha. Manastu parabuddhihi. Manastu parabuddhihi. Yo buddhe paratas tusaha. Yo buddhe paratas tusaha. Indriyani parani ahuhu. Indriyebhya param manaha. Manasaha tu para buddhihi. Yaha buddhehe parataha tu saha. He says, going back to these indriyas, the manas and the buddhi, he says, indriyani parani ahu. They say that the wise people say that the indriyas, the sense organs, are superior to what? To the deha. Deha's not in here, it's understood. The indriyas are superior to the deha. Then what? Then indriyebhyaha parammanaha. The manas is superior to the indriyas. Okay. Then what? Manasaha tu para buddhihi. The buddhi is superior to the manas, to the mind. Yaha buddhehe parataha tu saha, says. But that one, the Atma, who is superior to the buddhi. So, here, when they say the superior, usually what is understood by that is three different things. Something is superior, like when they say that the indriyas are superior to the body, in the sense that they are more subtle, the indriyas are more subtle to the body, it becomes more pervasive. The sense organs pervade the body, they extend beyond the body in terms of perception. So they're more subtle than the body. They're interior to the body because they're aware of the body. They're also pervasive to the body. Right? And so because they're pervasive, interior, and more subtle they're considered superior. So superior is in the sense of really subtlety and interiority. So now if you look at it like that, so the sense organs are more subtle, pervasive, and more extensive, have a big, wider range than the physical body. The manas, the mind, is superior to the sense organs because of the mind uses the sense organs. Because of the mind is attached to the sense organs function. The mind is also can function on its own, right? The mind has the world of imagination. And so it itself uses the sense organs, so it's interior to the sense organs, pervades the sense organs, and is more spacious than the sense organs, has more pervasive than the sense organs. So the mind itself is considered interior and superior to the sense organs, more subtle. But the buddhi is interior to the mind, because the buddhi can control the mind. It can stop the mind. It can change the mind. It can hold the mind. Right? It controls the mind. And so because of that, the buddhi is interior to the mind. It is pervasive to the mind. It controls the mind, you know, and so therefore is considered more subtle. But superior to that is the Atma, is the self because of which the buddhi shines, because of which the buddhi is, because of which the buddhi exists, right? And so he says here, understand that this is the order, right, of subtlety. So we're stopping it here. We're going to stop it at the sense organs, right? This comma, at the sense organs. But more subtle than the sense organs is the mind. More subtle than that is the buddhi. And much more subtle than that is your own being, which in fact is not being affected by that at all. So now let's go to the last verse because it's a continuation.
I knew you were going to do that.
Well, because the two verses go again. That's right. Evam buddhe param buddhva, evam buddhe param buddhva, samstabhyatmanam atmana, jahi shatrum mahabaho, jahi shatrum mahabaho, kamarupam durasadam, kamarupam durasadam. Therefore, kim. In the introduction, Shankara introduces Tataha Kim, therefore what, he says. Evam buddhehe param buddhva samstabhya atmanam atmana jahi shatrum mahabaho kama rupam durasadam. He says, having known Evam, in this manner, that which is param buddhehe, that which is superior to the buddhi, which is the Atma, having known yourself, the Atma, in this manner, the Atma which is superior, interior, the very conscious being because of which the buddhi is illumined, so having known the Atma in this manner, which is superior to the buddhi, then what? Samstabhya atmanam atmana. Here the first atmanam is the mind. Having controlled, literally it says, having controlled, having resolved oneself by oneself, having pulled oneself in, having made oneself steady by oneself. Right? So it's not that the atma is going out and making the atma steady. So having made the mind, having had the buddhi, having pulled the mind in, right? Having made the mind steady. So samstabhya atmanam accusative, right? Atmana instrumental. In English we just say having made steady oneself by oneself. So what are you making steady? You're bringing in the sense organs, you're bringing in the mind, the buddhi is bringing in the sense organs, bringing in the mind, and making it rest in oneself, in the basha, that's what it's called. So the buddhi, bringing in the sense organs, bringing in the mind, makes that mind come to rest in oneself, right? So having understood that, having known the Atma, which is interior, pervasive, and innermost to the buddhi, having recognized that, then, having brought the mind in, the buddhi, having brought the mind in, brought the indriyas in, brought itself in to rest in that self, then, jahi shatrum, hey mahabaho, in that way, conquer, destroy this kama. Mahabaho means great armed one. It's like telling Arjuna, you're strong enough to do this, Arjuna. You can do this. This is an inner battle, right? You're a great warrior. You have all this, you can do all of this outside. Now you have to be able to do this inside also. The kama is the enemy that takes away all of your shanti. It takes away your peace. It takes away your jnanam. And so it's this enemy that you have to bring under your control. So you can do this, he says. So conquer this enemy in the form of kama. This enemy, which is durasadam, which is this kama, which is so difficult to understand. You can never get to the bottom of it. You can never say, why do I have this desire? I have this desire, well, because I had this desire, but I had this desire because I had this desire. There's no end to these desires. There's no way to make sense of them all or understand them all in terms of themselves and why they have come. What you need to recognize is the truth of all of these desires. What is really, if you get to it, what is the truth of the whole thing? If you look at it in terms of, try to get to the bottom of a desire in terms of Maya, of what's going on with in Maya, it's trying to get to the bottom of the creation, right? Which has infinite cause and effect. You can never get to the root of anything in the creation. But if you really want to understand the truth of a desire, you have to understand the nature of yourself. The reason the desire is there in the first place is because of your atma ajnanam. It's because of self-ignorance. That's the only reason. That is what gives the gasoline to the desire. The desire is what? I want this so that I can be happy. If I want this so that I can be happy, what does that mean? I'm not happy. Why am I not happy? Right? Because I think I need this to be happy. Why do I think I need this to be happy? Because I've superimposed myself onto that object. Why have I superimposed myself onto that object? Because I don't know myself. It's very, very simple. The reason that the mind suffers from sorrow is because of agitation, really. It's because I'm seeking something. The moment your mind is not seeking, it's fine. So it's really, when your mind, even for an ajnani, when your mind is not seeking or asking anything to be different, then the mind isn't creating any ripples and all is well with me. You know? That's from an ajnani standpoint. How do you experience that in the world? Well, you take a walk in nature, you listen to some music, you fulfill a desire. You know, when you wake up in the morning and slip back into pure jnana, you know, where the mind doesn't want anything to be different. Those moments, all is well with me. What is the state of a jnani? All is well with me. Why? Because I don't want anything to be different. Why don't I want anything to be different? Because myself is the root, is the source of wholeness, and I is the source of the ananda, and I don't have to go anywhere for that. My mind doesn't have to leave its nest to search for ananda. And so my mind resting in ananda experiences the world. So where is for jnani? Where is kama? There is no kama. There's dagda bija kama, burnt seed kama. Right? Because the mind can't say, I want to be happy when it is happy. The mind can't say, I want ananda when it's enjoying ananda. The mind can't say, I need this to gain ananda, when its very self is the ananda that it had spent lifetime seeking for because of ajnanam. And so when that self is recognized, the mind resting in that happiness then experiences the world, and the kamas are fine because they're not real kamas. I want this, but not so that I can be happy. I want this. It would be nice to have this. But my well-being is not at stake. That is the jnani. When the kama, because of lack of vairagya or whatever it is, comes up with more pull than that, that's when the buddhi says, wait. I don't think so. Let's look at that for a minute. Let's bring in a karma yoga buddhi. Right? Let me go with that, but let me go with that. Let me go with that desire, you really want that, but let me go with it with a karma yoga buddhi. Right? So the karma yogi will say that. Because then protected. Then that karma is under your control. You have an attitude. I will go after that desire, but I'll take, I won't go that kaushalam, I won't go beyond dharma. I won't go outside of the boundaries of dharma, because that's not worth it to me. And I'll accept the results of my actions, the results of my pursuit, as prasad from the Lord. That's the karma yoga buddhi. What are the, so the jnani might say, if the jnani does, if the karma doesn't have that, that when that karma comes up, no, I don't think so. Right? If I need to go through, need to go for it, because I have a strong desire, I'll go with it with that karma yoga buddhi. See the difference? If I go with the karma yoga buddhi, the buddhi is still there, and I'm fulfilling my desire. So that also blesses me. If I have nishtha and a desire arises, that desire is not something I'm going to go with in any way that would take me away from myself. And so the kaushalam and the dugdha bija is there. If the kaushalam and the dugdha bija, kaushalam means that I haven't lost the karya akarya. What is to be done, what is not to be done. So if that dharma, adharma is there, clear for me, and there's no problem with the desire, if I fulfill it, fine. If I don't, fine. It's not a problem. There's no problem. And so then I just live my life. You only take note when the warning signs come. The warning signs are the stress and the tension and the little grief, the stress that comes in the mind that's causing pain. Pain is a wonderful warning. You know, just like if the body gives you a little pain and you have to go and take care of that. If your mind's giving you a little pain, then, I need to spend some time there. I need to reorientate myself. I have to be with myself differently. I have to be with the world a little bit differently. So that's those little moments of emotional pain, like physical pain, those moments of emotional pain, that's a place where that needs some attention. That's where my sadhana should be located. That's where the viveka comes in, the karya, what should be done, what should not be done. What is a better way to be with this? You know, all of that, what we call vichara, all that analysis comes then. But all of this becomes clear for the one who has self-knowledge. All of these things that we're talking, that's why Krishna ends this chapter. He says, having known yourself, the one who's superior to the buddhi, means having known the atma, having known yourself, all of this falls into perspective. Be like this with your kamas. Kama krodha, kama, which is that lack of vairagya, the kama krodha, that's what causes all the pain. So be with the kama krodha in this way. Get rid of it, destroy it, overcome it. Overcome it in this way. You know, don't analyze the kama to death. And this durasadam, which has no end, the kama has no end. Understand it in terms of your knowledge. And then you'll destroy it. He says, jahi shatrum. You'll destroy that. You'll destroy the enemy. That karma which is acting as an enemy. The karma which is an enemy. That karma you'll destroy. The karma that's not an enemy, you don't have to destroy. The karma that's a dugdha bija, where the buddhi has not been overwhelmed, that doesn't take you away from your well-being, doesn't take you away from your knowledge, that you don't have to destroy, because it's no problem at all. It's the karma that takes you away from your jnana. That karma, you have to nip it in the bud and hold it up and do the vichara on that. Okay? So... she hasn't given you what you want.
These are our verses.
Let's see if he has this. Oh, yes, okay. Om Tatsata. Om Tatsata. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su. Upanishad Su. Upanishad Su. Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastra. Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastra. Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade. Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade. Karma Yoga Nama. Karma Yoga Nama. Tritiyodhyayah. Tritiyodhyayah. Om Tat Sat. Om, which is the name for Brahman, that which is the whole, all that is. Om, that Brahman is Ishwara. Om, like Tattvamasi. Om Tat, that is Ishwara. And that is Sat, that is the reality. Om Tat Sat. Thus, the Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su, in this Srimad Bhagavad Gita, Upanishad Su, which is an Upanishad, which is considered to be as considered as an Upanishad, is given the same legitimacy, the same pramanatvam as the Upanishad. Brahma Vidyayam, in this Yoga Shastra, in this Brahma Vidya, in the Bhagavad Gita, which is considered to be an Upanishad, which is teaching in this Brahma Vidya, which is a Yoga Shastra, so it teaches Brahma Vidya and the Karma Yoga, so both. This Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade, in this Samvada, this teaching, the Samvada is between Krishna and Arjuna. Samvada is a dialogue where the teaching is taking place. It's not just talking. The Samvada is a dialogue that involves teaching. So in this dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, where the Lord is teaching Arjuna, so in this karma yoga, this which is called, has for its yoga, here yoga is subject matter. This third chapter, the Tritiya Jayaha, the third chapter, which is called karma yoga, that which has for its subject matter, karma. So this is the name of the chapter. So this is now complete.
This one didn't get translated.
No, it's there.
It is?
Yeah, it's there in the page order as well. So let's just take a minute. I'll show you later. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Your voice made it.
Yeah.
Just barely. Tomorrow.
No, I'm okay. I'm really fine now. Voice is hanging on.
So what is the difference between kaushalam and viveka?
Viveka. Viveka can, usually when we use viveka, we use atma and anatma viveka, discrimination between the self and the not self. But we can use it in karya akarya viveka, the discrimination between what is to be done and what is not to be done. So if you think of just in terms of discrimination, discriminative, sometimes we translate it discriminative analysis, right? So usually when we are thinking viveka as viveka vairagya, it's one of the qualities for an adhikari. We mean to be able to discriminate the real from the unreal. What is nitya, timeless, from what is anitya. So it's atma, anatma, viveka. But if you think of it as discrimination, we can apply it also to karya, akarya, what is right, what is wrong to do, dharma, adharma. And so this word, when we think of karma yoga, there's two aspects. The kaushalam, you know, which is having the viveka or the ability to decide what is appropriate action in a given situation based on dharma, adharma, and then just also your skill, life skill, you know. Dharma and dharma and just general life, what is appropriate behavior in a situation. It's called kaushalam. And then the karma yoga buddhi, what is the prasada buddhi, where you do the action, but you take the result as prasad from the Lord. So these are the two aspects of karma yoga. And they really, the understanding that the karma yoga buddhi, it allows your, that's what allows the mind to mature. That understanding allows the mind to mature without kind of repressing it. You know, like saying, you're okay, you're not supposed to have any desires. You know, or you have, say, you have a really strong desire for something. It's not, it's not reasonable for you to dismiss that desire. You really need to do it, you want to do it, you want it. But then, that's fine. When that's, in that case, have that karma yoga buddhi, because that will allow you to pursue the desire, but to maintain appropriate action and to take the results as prasad from the Lord. So you remain in relationship with Ishvara. You have an attitude to where you accept the results of the action, the results of your endeavor, as prasad from the Lord, which allows the mind to maintain that shanti, right? Because if you accept it as prasad from the Lord, then it doesn't mean that you didn't get your way, but, you know, that's what's been given to you at this time from Ishwar. So you remain in relationship to Ishwar. That allows for the buddhi to remain, to keep the shanti. And then as you go on studying, you know, the desires that are important to you, that have a grip on you, you know, those begin to fall off. It's not that you become desireless. The grip of the desire, where I have to have this in order to be happy, the worry that the desire causes, if this doesn't go my way, the way that I need it to go, I won't be happy. So there's a lot of fear comes around desire, especially when we look at our lives and we're looking into the future. We can't see how the future is going to go. If it goes this way, you know, I'll be destitute. Right? So many things. If this were to happen, or catastrophic thinking, you know. If this were to happen, if something was to happen to my loved ones, or if I were to lose all of my money, all of the various things, catastrophic thinking is we create things in our mind and then that are tragic that I won't be able to handle. What makes it catastrophic thinking? Any of these things, the horrible things that we think they could happen, well, we don't know. But what makes it catastrophic thinking is this. If this happens, I'll be destroyed. If this happens, my life will be ruined. If this happens, I'll live a life of sorrow and misery because I won't be able to cope with it. Right? And so pulling our mind back from that type of catastrophic thinking, doing the best we can with what Swamiji says. And I think that this is just, I live this, this is just, I just do the very best I can every moment. Do what I can with what life is giving me. And that's what I do. No more, no less. Life, and life is giving you something every single moment, and it's not going to stop. As long as you've got this body, life is giving you something. So every single moment, whatever it is giving, that is your field, right? That's your field. And so you deal with it as it presents itself to you. Until a person gains knowledge, what is the most natural for the mind is to be regretful of worrying about the past, worrying about what has happened, and fearing what will happen, projecting into the future, thinking, you know, imagining the future, and worrying about the future and worrying about the past. It's both ways, projection both ways. And I think that as you become more, as your mind settles down, it takes time. The mind, you have to remember, the mind has had lifetimes, life, beginningless lifetimes. You have to give it time to be able to just enjoy being in the present. Now, enjoying being in the present, there's a couple of things involved. There's the mind's feeling comfortable and at home with myself, that it has a home base that's always in the present. So the mind's secure with that home base. And then also recognizing Ishvara. You know, the Prarabdha Karma and Ishvara. If you recognize Prarabdha Karma also, you're recognizing Ishvara.
Why is that so important?
Because it means there's something bigger to your life than just Edward walking through an inert creation. Having to make it work, you know. If you see that the moment to moment is the prarabdha, your very upadi, who you are, is a part of that prarabdha. Your prarabdha is you, the jiva, your body, your mind, your sense organs, the entirety of this jiva being here, and the surrounding. The whole thing is the prarabdha. So that whole thing is what's, that's a movement of the whole thing, from birth to death. It's not just that the prarabdha is carried in your body. The whole environment is the prarabdha. That includes your body. Right? And so it's this motion. So that's why what Swamiji says, you know, I just do what is to be done moment by moment, because that is the prarabdha. Right? And in this prarabdha that's presenting itself to you, really the free will is basically in your attitude. It's the attitude that makes this situation what it is. If the situation is causing tremendous pop of tremendous pain or pleasure or whatever, your attitude is something that you can manipulate with the free will, with your knowledge. You know, so there's a lot of freedom in terms of attitude. In terms of a doing, you can move about within the main course.
But you know what? That it's kind of like trusting Ishvara is going to look after things, you know, or take care of just me.
Well, you know why that's fine, and that's true. But I'll tell you why that's a problem.
Yeah.
As long as you want it. No, not yet. Not like that.
The wrong answer?
I'm just tete-a-tete with Edward.
Okay.
The prarabdha, whatever it is my prarabdha. It's not somebody else's prarabdha. Okay? And that is what I am where I'm supposed to be. This is mine. It's what I have, and it's where I'm supposed to be. As long as my ananda is not at stake, I can enjoy and feel at home in the prarabdha that I have. It's the most secure place that I can be. That's why Look, why in the previous verse, Krishna said, don't try to do somebody else's prarabdha that's fraught with fear, because that's not where you are supposed to be. If you just are with your own prarabdha, you're sitting in the middle of yourself, you know, where you're supposed to be. The problem comes in is when I myself don't feel happy. In other words, my mind isn't resting in myself for its ananda. My mind is resting in the world for its ananda. Then that's fraught with fear. Because what if Ishwara doesn't have the same idea as I do? You know? Ishwara is going this way, I'm going this way.
Yeah.
Who's stronger? You know, so you just get batted around. But if you're in your prarabdha and just responding to what is here, then you'll find that yourself, you're very vital. And this is your place. Nobody can take it away from you, because it's yours. It's your very karma. Nobody can do anything. They can threaten, they can do whatever. They can do all kinds of things. But they can't move in on your prarabdha. In your prarabdha, you're safe. And so enjoy what you have. Like Swamiji, he told me this a long time ago. I must have been whining and complaining about all kinds of things. He said, listen, what you don't have is infinite. Enjoy what you have. Be grateful for what you have, what is here. Because what you don't have is infinite. But this you have. You know? And so don't bother wanting somebody else's set of things. Have your set of things. This is it. So let these set of things that you have be sacred to you, be important to you, be meaningful to you. But in order to have that type of a buddhi, the mind has to have a resting place where it feels at home and secure. So as you gain your knowledge, your mind sits at home in the fullness of your being, then you can appreciate Ishwara. Until then, though, there's lots to complain about.
Yeah, well, what about like this tsunami of foreclosures just taking everything out from you?
You know what?
Yeah.
I would much rather be a jnani in the midst of those foreclosures than not one. Yeah. I'm serious. And you know, Swamiji said once, and I could say this for myself too, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, time will tell. Mm-hmm. It's put to the test. But because but I'm speaking from the experience too. You get what you need in your life. It's your life. It's not that you're going to live forever. It's not that you're not going to have diseases. It's not that you're not going to have hardship. That's part of this loka. You know, in fact, Vidyaranya says in Panchadashi, you know, it's too late to not have to suffer pain. You're here, you have a body, and there's pain on this loka. So there's not an escape from that. It's just part of the mix. Nothing you can do about it. Right? You've got a body, you've got a mind, you've got sense organs, there's birth and death, there's change and catastrophe all around you, so this is it. But within that reality, you know, here you are in this loka, in this life. If you just let yourself be with what the universe gives you, you'll be fine. Now, I would say like this. Now, right now, the universe is giving us this. This is what we have. This is our life. This is our prarabdha. If everybody gets foreclosed and we all lose our jobs, or a bunch of us do, maybe I'll be living out there in the park. Well, what am I going to do about it? Maybe I'll just be sitting there giving my classes. I'm going to just do whatever is there.
Well, the podcast intervention to
a Yeah. Awesome. But I'm sure. What are you going to do? But do you see that? What are you going to do? One event happens after the next. You're there and you're responding to that event. Yourself isn't going to change. You know, your mind isn't going to change. If your mind is with yourself, that's not going to change. What is changing is whatever the environment is going to throw up for you. the environment, the world right now is throwing up some pretty heavy karma right now. And so how is that going to turn? How are we going to be? My immediate family is being quite affected. My sister and her family are being affected. My brother's being affected. My brother-in-law is being affected. So many people are being, and so many people I know are being affected. I'm not that affected yet, maybe a little bit. What are we going to do? How are we going to deal with it? Yourself isn't being affected. Your ananda need not be affected. But your life will be affected. And then what are we going to do? Okay, this is the life then. So you deal with it. What are you going to do if you get sick? You deal with it. You can't say, I'm never going to get sick.
Carol, you said one time your friend Greg, I guess, said find the yes behind the no.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I try to think about that too. You know, it's like...
That's a nice one.
Yeah.
Greg, you know, Greg Comello, the priest who I used to, he died last year. He and I used to team teach. He taught with me at school. He was a priest. One of the things he used to teach, he's also a Vedantin, very much so. I think he used to teach is, you know, if you've gotten a big no, life has given you a big no, something you really want, and boom, it's fun, you know. What's the yes behind the no? Right? Because if something's been denied to you, there's something else that's open for you. What is that? It's very interesting, because it's true. Mm-hmm. It's true, you've been denied this thing, absolutely. But what is open? Where's the yes there? That's very meaningful, kind of a meditation to really see, because there is a yes there.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could ship me off to India to be the best thing.
But it's the whole essence of moksha, you know? It's like
the
loss. With the moksha comes the loss of the illusion. Yeah. So there's a loss, but then there's a gain.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, huh?
That's beautiful, yeah.
So free will, where's that anchored? Is that also anchored in the bhukti?
Free will is still accessible to you because it's like a muscle. That's the best way to look at free will. It's a capacity. You have capacity to choose. The thing is, when you have knowledge, you don't have to really exercise your free will. You don't have the same attitude toward, I have to use my will to do this. It's not that you don't have the capacity to choose and to do. You do. That's the buddhi has that capacity. But we are more likely to appreciate the life that's unfolding rather than taking a feeling that there's that much doership. Now, there's a lot of doership is imposed on your life where I have to do this or I have to make this happen. A lot of times, you know, it's like you think you're making what's happening happen. Right? So then there's a lot of stress there too. You know, because I'm the one who's making it happen, I have to make it happen. But actually, it's happening. And so if you just relax and participate in what's happening, there's a lot more of a flow there. In the Kena Upanishad, in the second chapter of the Kena Upanishad, is a story of all of the gods are at a war with the Asuras, you know. And they win the war, and then they're so proud of themselves. They're all boasting to each other, you know, how great we have done, you know, how great we are that we did this and we were able to conquer the Asuras and to win the war. And Bhagavan has to come and nicely tell them, it wasn't you, it was me. It's a very beautiful verse. Very beautiful chapter.
Really?
Yeah, because Ishwara is saying this is my unfoldment.
Really? And
yeah. Hmm. This is my unfoldment.
That's a big change in perspective. Isn't
it? It's an important change in perspective.
Well, if it's the prakriti that's doing everything, the atma doesn't do anything.
Right.
So then, for the jnani, the aham, the I, lands on the atma, which isn't doing anything.
That's right.
So then what's doing everything? It's a property, and what's that? It's Ishwara.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So from that standpoint, also for the jnani, there is never any doership. You know, but from the standpoint of the buddhi, disappears, let me do this or let me do that. But it's all Dagdabhicha.
Well, as time goes on, do you get more used to that idea? Or, I mean, it's just such a radical change of
thinking. That's what I say, you know. In the Gita itself, it says what's night for a jnani is day for an ajnani,
yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, you need shravana. You do. You have to do shravana until the mind doesn't need to do shravana anymore.
Hmm.
Until the mind sees, because as a jiva, you have a physical body living within the creation, looking out at the creation through your sense organs and acting upon it with your limbs, right? With your organs of action. So the whole upadhi that you have is geared toward participation as a jiva in this creation. Right? And you have lifetimes of that. And then all of a sudden, because of your great punya, you recognize, a question comes, this isn't working. What is the truth of all of this? There's no way for me to gain the fullness or the wholeness I seek as a being, as a human being. This universe can't provide that for me. What is the truth of the whole thing? Then you become a mumukshu, and when you become a mumukshu, Bhagavan has to give you a teacher. That's as the tradition goes. So then you come to the teacher, and the teacher then shows it to you. But what you see is the absolute antithesis of what you had thought before. Instead of you being an individual, a little conscious bubble individual in a sentient creation, seeking out your way and your happiness and trying to fulfill yourself, you recognize that your being is the very self of the entire creation. The whole creation comes from you, is sustained by you, goes back to you. That mind has to understand a lot to be able to know that, as opposed to kind of take it as an interesting belief. But to know it, to know it beyond any doubt, like you use your... When I say what I mean by that, you trust your eyes, just in Vyavahara. You know beyond any doubt that you can stand up. You see the door there. You trust completely that the door, that you are seeing a door there. It's not an illusion that you can walk there, go through the door. And so we take our means of knowledge for granted. We take our knowledge for granted. It's firmly rooted because we understand it, and it bears inquiry. Right? It withstands inquiry. Self-knowledge has to be like that. We have to know it. We have to see it. We have to recognize it. It has to be able to withstand any and all inquiry completely, so that it's known. That's knowledge, right? Otherwise, what is it? It's a belief. It's a faith. A nice faith. Gee, is that, that's a really, I believe that, but is it really true? You know, that's faith. That's, most faiths are like that. I believe this. I trust this to be true. I hope it is true. I believe it's true. I have faith that it's true. I don't know that it's true, but this is what I believe. Moksha is not belief. Moksha is knowledge. And yourself is here to be known. This world is here to be known. Just this room is enough. That this room, I am here, the world is here, it's enough to have the direct, immediate recognition of this.
Well, when you were talking about Ishvara, you know, it's his plan, his doing. Do we look upon him as a some kind of type of a person, or is that a wrong way to approach that?
Yeah, because if you think of a person, you think
not
of
not the guy in the beard up there. I'm not talking about.
Well, if you're not talking about the guy in the sky,
no.
Then, if you say person, yes, in this sense, Purusha. One name for Ishvara is the Purusha. Purusha means person. The Purusha Sukta is a famous sukta, you know, chant that we learn where we look at the, where we would say person. It's not a person with arms and legs. or a separate mind, or a separate buddhi, or separate sense organs. It's the whole infinite creation is manifest knowledge. It's infinite knowledge that has me, conscious being, as its self. So that's Ishvara. And why do we say person? Why would we call this whole infinite conscious being a person? Well, why do you call yourself a person? Because the conscious being is there. You know, and so that's why when we do these meditations, where if I say imagine a meadow, or imagine a meadow, you recognize that that meadow, you are the self of the meadow. Right? You're the self of that. So now if there was just all there was your being and the meadow imagination, that's you. That's the person. That's the Purusha. So now imagine all there is your being, the being, conscious being, and the imagination, which is the manifest knowledge of the universe. So that is the being. So all that is the Purusha, is the person. But the person is the infinite manifestation of knowledge that has the self that is the self. You see? That's not a person with hands and legs looking down upon you.
No, but I mean, that sense of it wanting to be a person or a personage, you know.
But then you can worship Krishna or Rama or Saraswati or any of the forms. And the Lord says that. Krishna says that. You know, worship me in whatever form. Because it's easier for you to have a relationship with a form than you worship me in that form. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
No, you can come in any form and I am the whole in that form.
So that's kind of the
Ishta Devata.
It's like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You can evoke the Lord in any form. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't diminish the Lord.
The name Ishvara, like everybody has a name. Persons have names, you know. So now you have this Ishvara, that's a name.
Ishvara means the Lord, but you would say Bhagawan. Call Ishvara Bhagawan.
Well, that shifts it again.
But it's the meaning behind the concept that is relevant, right? It's not the name.
It's not the name, no. There's a lot of names for the Lord. Ishvara, Isha.
Oh, they have billions of them over there in India, they do.
But what about this, you know, I didn't feel like I got my answer for this will thing.
Oh.
You know, you said, yeah, it's a muscle you can train, but which faculty does it fall?
Buddhi.
Buddhi. It does fall into the buddhi.
Buddhi. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
So, brother, Ishvara imagines this then? This is an imagination. Just like we have an imagination of the meadow, right?
Yeah.
And I'm the being of that. So Ishvara's imagination is all of this?
Yeah, but let's look at it like this. Yeah. If we say, it's an imagination, let's say knowledge. So say there's pure, just conscious being. No creation. Okay. Just the pure conscious being. Then with this pure conscious being has Maya, this Maya capacity. This Maya capacity manifests and goes into unmanifestation cyclically. When it manifests, what does that mean? It means that it's manifest knowledge. And then I use as an example, or Swamiji uses, and I use it because he uses it, and I think it works really well. Like your mind, when you have an imagination or a thought, that thought comes from the unmanifest to the manifest. It's manifest knowledge. So right now, if I ask you to think of a car, think of a car that you weren't thinking of a car before, probably.
No.
So when I ask you to think of it, that car comes from the unmanifest to the manifest. Right? So now think of Ishvara as being the consciousness with Maya. The Maya is what comes to manifest and unmanifest. When it is when it's manifest, It's manifest knowledge. What does that mean? It's completely known. Like if I ask you to think of a car, or think of your home, when you think of it, it is known. Whatever comes into your mind at any given time is known. That's manifest knowledge. Every thought that you have, manifest knowledge. An emotion, manifest knowledge, because it's known. So now, the whole creation comes into manifestation. We say manifest knowledge. Why? Because it is known. Right? And so that is Ishvara. The consciousness with Maya that allows for this whole manifestation of the creation is what we call Ishvara. Swamiji says manifest knowledge because the entire creation is known. Just like if you were to have a thought of a meadow or ask you to imagine a universe, the whole thing is known. So manifest knowledge.
But that known, that knownness, that's there even without the creation.
Even without the creation, because that's the very Swarupa. That's the very consciousness.
Yeah, I guess I don't get that because you say, like, I have an imagination. Imagination is known. That's true. But it's kind of subject-object. You know, I'm the knower, and the imagination is known.
Think of it like this. You have the imagination. At that point, there's the conscious me and the thought. That's all we're concerned about. Don't think about the buddhi and the manas and all of that. Just think about there's a conscious me and an imagination. Now, I am the self of the whole imagination, not part of it, right? That's Ishvara. So Ishvara is the self of the whole creation, not part of it. And so the entire creation is in consciousness, known. Just like if you have an imagination, the entire imagination is in consciousness, known. Now imagine, in that imagination, you enter it as a jiva. So now, you are both Ishvara and the jiva. The jiva is experiencing the imagination from within it, looking at it from within the with sense organs. But from your vantage point, you are the self of the whole imagination that includes the jiva, right? So now we say that imagination is totally known because of the pervasiveness of the sattva, the sattvic aspect. So the whole imagination is what we call manifest knowledge because the whole thing is known. I can withdraw it, project it again, right? I can withdraw that meadow, project the same meadow. So the knowledge goes into unmanifest condition, comes out. So now, if you understand just that phenomena in reference to the mind, switch now from the mind to Maya. Maya manifests, pervasiveness of sattva, sattva, rajas, and tamas, the pervasiveness of sattva, that is Ishvara. Right? So the self, with the manifest knowledge, the whole thing is known. That's what we call Ishvara. The Maya comes into unmanifest condition, goes, opens, closes, opens. Ishvara is the Brahman with that Maya capacity.
So when this thing opens and plays out, then is there an Ishvara there conducting the events?
No, because infinite knowledge, it is its own order. There's no little man there orchestrating.
It is Ishvara.
It is Ishvara. Yeah, the whole, infinite knowledge.
What about these devas defeating the...
those are all, that's all part of the play that goes on within Ishvara. Uh-huh. The devas and the asuras and all of that.
And what's that attributed to?
Two categories, right?
Well, the devas are devas.
Fun and games.
No, but I mean, who determines, how is it determined which is going to win out?
Well, okay. say you are having a dream, a complicated dream, right? And in your dream, the devas and asuras are having a big battle.
Yeah, okay? I had one of those last night.
Okay, yeah. So, you're having this big dream, but it's your dream, right? It's Edward's dream. But the devas and asuras in the dream think that it's their trip. They are the ones that are here in this inert creation, having this big deal going on, this big war going on, where actually it's Edward's dream. You know, and Edward could do whatever he wants. See what I mean?
But I was out of control. I was out of control in that thing too.
No, yeah, but you're a character in the dream. But what I'm saying, now I confused you. What I'm saying
no,
is
I'm that, trying to get Grant.
What I'm saying is that it's your dream. In that dream, there's all kinds of things going on, and all of the devas and asuras and all of the jivas are all taking credit for it. You know, I'm doing this and I'm doing that and I'm doing that. Where actually, this is a much bigger story. It's Ishwara's story, of which you are a part, right? And so that story is taking place. You find yourself in the story. You're not creating the story. So the devas and asuras aren't creating the story. They're in the story.
So then in this whole phenomenon, where is the place for an intimate, loving relationship between a jiva and Ishvara? Because if you really, if you do think of it like that, then it seems like the place for that is because the human mind needs it. And so it's possible along with...
You have to remember though, Kiki, if you say, the one who has the relationship is the human mind, which is, and the jiva, which is limited within the whole.
Yeah.
Right? That's true.
Right.
It's as true as Ishwara is the whole, as true the jiva is a limited part of that whole. So that is a real relationship. Right? And so the jiva that is limited can be in relationship with the limitless. So it's the limited mind in relationship to the limitless mind. And the limited mind can evoke the limitless mind in a form also, and have a relationship with that.
But I'm saying that that has no more significance than the limited mind evoking a different kind of relationship with Ishvara. Now, my limited mind may want to evoke a loving, intimate relationship with Ishvara. Another limited mind may want to evoke something else.
Yeah.
But there is no order to those. I mean, there's no precedence to those things. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, the general idea is that human beings have this.
Yeah, but look at our relationship, or your relationship with any person. You can evoke a horrible relationship.
Right. Or, and that's what I'm saying.
Or a positive relationship.
Right.
Or the most fulfilling relationship, the most unfulfilling relationship. And then you can also see that some people, Swamiji uses this example often. Here, you know, he uses this as a way to neutralize your own raga dveshas. Say there's one person, you have the most hideous, horrible relationship with that person. They can't stand you, you can't stand them. When you think them, it's hard for you to say anything good about the person. Okay. But that person has such a wonderful relationship with this other person.
Right.
And you see them. They love each other. They think that they're so good. And, you know, they enjoy each other so much. And even more confusing, you can have a wonderful relationship with this person who has a wonderful relationship with this person, but when you see this person, it's just horrible. It's all Maya, right? In terms of the different endless, countless types of relationships that you can have. Now, with Ishvara, what type of relationship, how do you evoke Ishvara? Like, there's even stories. There's one, you know, the one Ishvara was, the Lord was joking, this one, Vishnu, I think, was joking, this is my greatest devotee. The Rakshasa, who's right. Just all he thinks about is, I cannot stand you. He thinks about this, the Lord, 24 hours a day, and how terrible he is, and he does do nothing right. He never takes the right side. On. And so Bhagavan says, this is my greatest devotee because he's always thinking of me. He's always thinking of me. But now, when we're evoking Ishvara, you're evoking Dharma. You're evoking the Lord.
Yeah. I mean, so that relationship is preferred because it's dharmic, because it gives you...
It protects you.
Because it leads you to knowledge.
Yeah, and also, even in samsara, Dharma is the great protector, right? Then Dharma is where the Ananda is, in the universe, in the manifestation. What gives you the greatest Ananda is Dharma. Because even desire, fulfillment of a desire is very secondary. That pleasure, they call it prayas, that pleasure is so secondary to Dharma that if you were to fulfill a desire for pleasure that went against your Dharma, there would be, that pleasure would be tinged with pain. Whereas if you were to give up the pleasure for the Dharma, then the Dharma would be full of Ananda. That sacrifice would be, you know. So Dharma is the Lord, you know. Sometimes Swamiji almost says that when he talks about Ishvara as the infinite order. When you appreciate Ishvara, you're appreciating the infinite order of this creation. But you have to appreciate, but don't make it objective. Say if you think, oh, order like science away from the self. It's that the whole manifestation is an infinite manifestation of order, an infinite manifestation of knowledge, which is the self, you know, your own being. So, but in terms of the Lord, you have to think of the jiva in relationship to the total, and that relationship is as real as our relationship.
Say that again.
It's the same order, right?
Yeah.
It's the same order.
It's as real as this relationship.
Could you say that again?
The relationship with Ishvara is as real as our relationship, jiva to jiva, because it's all the same order. It's the same level of reality. Right? You are a part to the whole.
But that order of reality being Maya. Right?
Yeah. But so there's nothing like about, if you're not going
to,
yeah, if you're not going to, if you can't say it like that, though, as though it's only Maya. Because?
No, I said that being Maya, right?
Yeah.
Not only Maya.
Yeah.
So there's one way to see it, like all of this is myself, and then there's this sort of other way of relating to what's going on. You
get to enjoy all of them. Because that's why Shankara has written so many shlokas and stanzas that are bhakti, all bhakti. You know, because appreciating the Lord, appreciating Ishvara. He's written so many beautiful, you know, verses in praise of Bhagavan.
But that whole appreciation is for the same reason, for because it's dharmic and it gives you peace of mind, which then eventually leads to knowledge. Is that a way to...
I don't think my appreciation of Ishvara is just because it's dharmic. I think my appreciation with Ishvara, my relationship with Ishvara, is because I have a relationship with Ishvara. And because it's real. It's as real as my relationship to you. And then my relationship to you can be dharmic or adharmic. Hopefully it would only be dharmic, right? But it's not that I'm just having a relationship with Ishvara for convenience.
It's just that when you were growing up, you know, when you were a child, then, or you were samsari, I guess, the same thing. No, you say you should have an intimate, you know, that's how I grew up, that you should have an intimate relationship with Ishvara.
Yeah.
And then you have to sort of get to, you know, what lies beneath, what is that you're having.
But what happens is that the intimate relationship with Ishvara, you finally know Ishvara.
And then it's natural and not something that's forced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the intimate relationship with the Lord, say the faith that you had, a belief you had in the Lord, was there, you're praying to the Lord, you had a belief in Shraddha, then what happens is that is fulfilled. Because now you know who you're praying to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a fulfillment, there's a oneness.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
You know who the Lord is. In other words, you hope the Lord is there, but you don't know who the Lord is. With knowledge, you know who the Lord is. Because it's the innermost being that you are, is Ishvara. So you know there's a dvaita there. Yeah.
I kind of still have trouble going between these two orders of reality.
Yeah, there are levels of reality, that's very important, too. Because you have to you have to understand those levels or things will get confused.
Which levels? What
between
levels?
The absolute level where there just is one Brahman.
Yeah.
Then the Vyavahara, which is the whole Maya.
Yeah.
Then there's the Jiva and Ishvara.
Yeah.
But say with the Vyavahara, here's the whole manifest creation. your innermost being is the innermost being of the whole creation. So from the standpoint of the self, you are Ishvara. From the standpoint of the body, you are part of Ishvara. You would say, in that one beautiful verse, it says, from the standpoint of the body, O Lord, I am your servant. From the standpoint of the mind, O Lord, I am your bhakta. I am your devotee. From the standpoint of the self, O Lord, I am you.
Wow.
It's a beautiful, that beautiful verse. Huh?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where is that
coming from?
No, I have it in one of, it might be there yet, but I have it in one of my books.
Is that one of Shankar's songs?
But
I think it is, yeah.
It's also in the Ramayana when Ram says to Hanuman, Hanuman, why have you, how do you see me? You give up your
yeah, yeah, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Is it Tulsidas?
Yeah, because somehow, because of these two levels, I tend to see this other level of, you know, that kind of devotion to the Lord, you know, from the point of view on the relative level, as it's more, to me, it just seems more like it's a metaphor for, so I'm not really relating to that one very well, because I tend to see more as a metaphor for the absolute level. In other words, you have of course a loving relationship with the whole manifest reality when you know that it's your own manifestation. It's just you, so how could you not, you know, be loving and loving towards it? But so from that point of view, it's like a metaphor to me, bhakti. That's sort of, so it's hard for me though to really, as a practical matter, to relate to this thing of like, is that a problem?
No, I don't think okay. So, but.
What did he say?
I'm
saying that, well, okay, so what I'm trying to say is that for me, the idea of like, you know, from I can understand rationally from the relative level that me as a limited being would have devotion towards Ishvara as the totality.
And you can, maybe if you talk about it differently, Hal, it's the way you're using language. Like if you say, I as a limited being have devotion and love toward the total being.
Towards the total being, right.
And the limited being, this limited being is the jiva. The total being is Ishvara. So in fact, I am the jiva, I am Ishvara. From the standpoint of the jiva, I am part of Ishvara. So from the standpoint of the limited being, I am part of the total being.
Right.
But I am the self of the limited being, and I am the self of the total being. So I can appreciate all of this as just being myself. But when I'm appreciating it as just being myself, I'm appreciating it as myself from the standpoint of myself, not the standpoint of the body or the mind or the sense organs, which belong to this manifest. So now if I'm walking around as a jiva, looking at this manifestation, I can feel wonder and devotion and love for this infinite manifestation of myself, Brahman. Or I can talk like this, I can feel infinite devotion for Ishvara. But I know who Ishvara is, because Ishvara is my own being. So what suits you in terms of language?
That's the same question that I was asking, is that it just seems like, you know, for me, because I was raised that way, it's almost like a cultural thing of what suits your mind. Because, you know, it seems like what Hal is describing is perfectly...
It's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But it, whether you describe it that way or how you were describing it or if we describe it in bhakti language, the vision is exactly the same and the reality is exactly the same. Ishvara is still Ishvara. Whether you say this is a manifestation of total knowledge, which is my own being, or whether it's labeled as Ishvara because from the standpoint of the jiva, this is infinite knowledge and the jiva enjoys limited knowledge. You call it Ishvara as the Lord, as the recognizing this infinite creation as a conscious being. So you could say, from the standpoint of this infinite creation, you know, I am a conscious being. This infinite creation enjoys my own being. Mm-hmm. And then you recognize this infinite creation as a conscious being, but we label it as Ishwara. But if you're saying that it's only a metaphor, that this, and you don't are not recognizing that this is manifest knowledge, means the whole creation is a conscious being, mm-hmm. then you're dismissing what the Vedanta is saying.
Because it also seems to me devotion, or quote unquote, it's anything that's beautiful or strikes you as wondrous, or, you know, that's that theme of bhakti, isn't it? I mean, it's not...
Well, there's many, many ways to feel love or devotion or the wonder of it or the appreciation of it. There's not just one way.
Yeah.
But outside of Vedanta, bhakti doesn't always view the creation as a conscious being.
But we're only talking about bhakti in reference to Vedanta.
Right, which is a whole different...
But if you don't talk about it in reference to Vedanta, then you look at every religion in the world as praising the Lord in a different way. Yeah, but from the standpoint of knowledge, you know, there's billions of types of devotion, including studying the Upanishads.
Right.
That's devotion.
Yeah. Or a guy studying an insect in the middle of the Amazon. You know,
well, if he's just looking at it, it's the Lord. I've felt that way in India, seeing some of the flowers and some of the insects in India, in tropical countries, is absolutely unbelievable.
But whenever you see the order, I mean, just for myself anyway, like if I'm in nature and I just see this order, I mean, you just go, you know what I mean? Because it is,
it's awe-inspiring.
Nothing but order. Yeah. And it's so amazing. Mm-hmm.
But it's the seer behind the eyes, right? What? The seer behind the eyes who makes...
That recognizes.
Yeah, who recognizes the magic.